is Bean to Barstool, a podcast that looks at the intersections of craft beer and craft chocolate. My name is David Nilsson. I'm a professional beer writer and an advanced Cicerone, and the creator and host of this show. The music for this episode is by my dear friend, indie folk musician Anna P.S. You can find out more about Anna's music in the show notes or at her website, annapsmusic.com. You can find links and information about our guests in the show notes as well. I hope you enjoy this episode of Bean to Barstool. In September, on one of the first weekend days where you could just begin to tell autumn would soon arrive in Ohio, my wife and daughter and I drove to a local nature preserve for a walk. There wasn't another soul in the entire forest, and we wandered lazily through the woods, crossing logs across streams and photographing spiders and trying to identify bird calls. My daughter, Yosie, turned 13 this summer. She's tasted along with my wife and I on our sensory adventures over the years and has an excellent palate and plenty of curiosity. She's heard me talk any number of times about the link between our chemical senses of smell and taste and our memories and emotions, and she asked an astute question as we walked through the patchwork of sunlight and shadow in the forest. Can our sensory memories circle around and begin to reference themselves? When we talk about the aroma-memory connection, we tend to refer back to things we experienced as children, or places that were once familiar to us, a grandmother's kitchen, a family holiday tradition. But what if the beer or chocolate I'm tasting reminds me of itself? What if the emotions it stirs and the memories it evokes are from a previous experience of tasting that same beer or chocolate? In the first episode of this podcast, I talked about tasting Oud Goose in a legendary beer bar in Bruges, Belgium, and how its agrarian aromas brought to mind smells from my rural childhood growing up in the Midwest. Now, when my wife and I drink a similar beer, it evokes images not only of that pastoral background, but also of tasting those same beers in a country on the other side of the world in 2014. I'd had plenty of sour beers before that first Belgian trip, but that was the first time I had ever processed through the sensory experience I was having with them. It added a new bead to the string of memories attached to those smells and tastes. In that first episode, we also discussed how tasting our favorite indulgences with people from different cultural backgrounds from ourselves can expose us to new sensory experiences and vocabulary, giving us a larger crayon box from which to color in our future tasting experiences and engaging our empathy for recognizing the links between us. For Harshith Gupta of Madhu Chocolate in Austin, Texas, and Jose Lopez of Casa Humilde Cerveceria Artesanal in Chicago, Illinois, these sensory touchstones are about connecting back to childhood experiences and keeping their connections to their cultures vibrant and vital, as well as proactively offering those experiences and connections to new people who might not otherwise experience them. There is not only creativity and skill involved in this, but also vulnerability and generosity. I'm grateful for the opportunity to experience their cultural memories through their chocolate and beer, and I think you will be too during this episode. Brothers Jose and Javier Lopez are from the Hermosa neighborhood of Chicago and founded their brewery, Casa Humilde Cerveceria, from their childhood home. The brewery operates out of District Brewyards, an innovative taproom concept that brings four breweries, Casa Humilde, Around the Bend, Bold Dog, and Burnt City, together around a shared seating area, allowing customers to choose and pour their own beers from any of the four breweries. Jose and Javier got their start as homebrewers, as most craft brewers did, and from their earliest batches have infused their beers with flavors and ingredients from their Mexican heritage. Beers using prickly pear cactus, hibiscus, cacao, coffee, piloncillo sugar, and others connect these brothers to the sensory memories of their childhoods and the culinary traditions of their culture, and offer windows through which those of us outside those traditions can peer in and take a look. Several of their beers are based on Belgian ale styles, and one uses no additional flavor ingredients at all. Campesino is a saison, a French word for season. Saison is a Belgian style sometimes referred to as farmhouse ale. The often told origin story for the style holds that it was brewed on Belgian farm estates in the 19th century and given to seasonal farm workers while they labored in the fields. There's likely a thread of truth to that story, though it's probably not as direct a lineage as some brewery marketing departments would like us to believe. Regardless of how much of that story is romance and how much is reality, the agrarian imagery of the style has caught on in the popular imagination, and Jose and Javier chose campesino, the Spanish word for farmer, for the beer. Campesino is dry and effervescent, with light lemony hop notes, a subtle underlying minerality, and gentle clove and pepper fermentation notes. It perfectly balances on the rustic but refined tightrope the best beers of this style walk. To learn more about Casa Humilde's beers using ingredients from Mexican tradition, I reached out to Jose and asked him how this all began. Appropriately, he started with a story from childhood about eating prickly pear cactus on road trips into Mexico.
Just tell me a little bit about how you use these flavors to kind of tell part of your story through these beers.
Man, best one would probably be the prickly pear one on the Bali. Well, we know them as tunas, the prickly pears in Mexico. That's pretty much just the memory of us driving to Mexico every year, every summer, and driving through, and my dad always picking up on the side of the road, pretty much ready to go, ready to eat prickly pears in a bag. That's pretty much what inspired that beer. And we decided to kind of throw it in there and play around with it with our one of our farmhouse, which ended up being Nopali.
You said you'd get these ready to eat. How do you eat these normally? Peel them, or how do you eat a prickly pear cactus?
You would peel them, yeah. Yeah, you would peel them and just pretty much just eat them like that. Yeah, just pretty much go to town on them.
Can you describe that flavor to me a little bit?
It's more of a refreshing flavor to us, and it worked out well because it came through in the beer just how we know the flavor. Kind of has like similar to a watermelon in flavor. Mm-hmm. So you get a little earthiness, a little refreshingness from that kind of watermelon flavor. Not a lot of sweetness from that fruit, which we like, you know, because we wanted the beer not to be just like a sweet beer like some fruit beers can be. We wanted it to actually be representative of the actual fruit, the flavor, and it worked out just well. I mean, we're happy with it, and it's one of our best sellers, actually, Nopali. So people have really come to enjoy it.
So when you're making a beer like this, do you start with this ingredient that you want to use and figure out a beer that would work, or do you start with the beer and then kind of figure out what flavors to bring into it?
It can go either way. Sometimes we will start with the ingredient and then kind of see what kind of style we think would work. And then sometimes we brew it and it doesn't work at all, which is sometimes a little frustrating, but fun at the same time. For example, we wanted to do a mango one not too long ago, and we decided to go with a good quality mango puree that we found, but it didn't come through in the beer. We brewed it a couple of times and we're like, no, this is not what we think it is. So we're revisiting that one. I'm kind of tweaking the base recipe and playing around with small 5-gallon batches, 7-gallon batches for now. But yeah, sometimes it can go either way. With that one in particular, with Nopali, the prickly pear farmhouse, we kind of already had in mind kind of a saison farmhouse style beer. And we wanted that earthiness, so the yeast we use and our grain bill, everything kind of comes together for that earthiness on its own. So we thought it would be great with the prickly pear. And we brewed it, I think, maybe once or twice, and we were happy with both brews. And yeah, that one just happened to work out for us. We played around with other fruits as well. Like I said, sometimes it's just hit or miss.
Can you share an example of a time where you started with an ingredient you wanted to use and then had to figure out what a beer would be from the ground up that would work with that?
Well, our table beer, our hibiscus table beer, so that's a 3.4 percenter. So we brewed that one on its own. And that was kind of to be a base for many different infusions. We wanted that with hibiscus, which worked out great, but we've tried it with other stuff like mango as well. We tried on that one that it just didn't work. But no, for the most part, we have an idea with the base. I think it's that's just because it's already kind of in our heads what we kind of feel or have an idea what would work. So we always kind of, as soon as we think of a fruit, we're like, oh, we think it could work in this type of beer, and kind of just go at it.
So with that one, with the hibiscus, that's a mezita. What would hibiscus typically be used in you know, Mexican culinary setting? You know, I'm familiar with it from tea. Would it be used in a different context in your background?
Well, the most popular form would be an agua fresca. Like if you go to a Mexican restaurant, they'll have horchata, which is the rice water. They'll have the limeades. They'll have like a cantaloupe water, agua de melon, or they'll have agua de Jamaica, which is always a darker, the purple, deep purple looking one. So that's pretty much where we known it from all our lives. Just going to eat with the family, Mexican, or anytime we go out to a Mexican restaurant, you kind of enjoy your food with one of the aguas frescas. Jamaica's always one of them. So we kind of grew up just drinking it like that. Yeah, we didn't play, at least in our household, play with it as far as cooking too much, besides tea here and there that my mom would make. But that's about it. We knew it from that, and mostly from the agua frescas from the Mexican restaurants.
We'll be right back.
Hey everyone, 5th Street Brew Pub in Dayton, Ohio is one of our sponsors at Bean to Barstool and Final Gravity, our print beer zine, and they just happen to be one of my favorite hometown breweries. They're one of the only cooperatively owned breweries in the country, a testament to their community focus and support. Inside a building from the 1850s in the historic neighborhood of St. Anne's Hill, 5th Street Brew Pub offers a warm, cozy atmosphere and excellent beer and food. And you can take your favorite beers to go with their Gem City Swing Tops, elegant swing top bottles filled straight from the taps with regular favorites like St. Anne's Pills and Rough Gem Farmhouse Ale, or current seasonals like Noel Belgian Dark Ale with vanilla and cinnamon, or Velvet Anxiety, a bourbon barrel imperial stout brewed with cacao nibs from Mezzo Cacao. If you're in the Dayton area, head over to 5th Street to hang out or grab beer to go. And if you're visiting Dayton, and you should, make sure 5th Street is on your list. Cheers.
Now, both of those beers, the Nepali and the Mesita with prickly pear and hibiscus, those are both very bright, vibrant flavors. With something like Pilan, your Belgian Golden Strong, where you're using Pilan CO sugar, that's more of like an earthy, deeper, more comforting flavor. How do you get that to still come through in an expressive way where it's still contributing to the profile of the beer?
That we played around a little bit, just kind of where we added. At the end of the day, it's just sugar, but we've played around of where we're throwing it into the boil is where we throw it in. So it's a way later towards the end of the boil to kind of keep as much of that flavor in with the beer. Mm-hmm. And it worked out for us, especially because, I mean, it has other flavors in there. It's still like a traditional Belgian with the coriander, with the orange peel. And we felt it would just work. Just the deepness, the richness of the flavor of it. Mm-hmm. And it so happened, yeah, it worked out for us, and people have enjoyed it, which we thought was not the most popular style, you know, a Belgian or a farmhouse like Cezanne. It's not the most commercial, I would say, but it's something that we felt we can take something that we already enjoy and add our twist to it.
So all three of those, like you just mentioned, are Belgian-based styles. What drew you toward those, and is there any unique way that those fit in with the kind of flavor ingredients you're using?
Yeah, I think the main thing for us is just that earthiness. Like we're huge fans of Saisons, of Belgians. We're just, I don't know, we discovered those beers, those styles, and we kind of just fell in love with that style. You know, we obviously we love all types of beers. We do porters, we do some stouts, so we do IPAs and all that stuff. But yeah, I think it's just that earthiness that kind of draws us in, and kind of the easier drink and like nothing too crazy alcohol. We don't go too crazy like on our ABVs. I think our strongest is our stout Tempestad, which we'll be back in fall. Other than that, Pilon is probably the strongest at around 7%. And then everything else is, we got a 6.3, and everything else is like below 6 pretty much. Yeah.
Switching away from the Belgian beers, tell me a little bit about Cafecito, your coffee beer.
So Cafecito, yeah, we wanted we're big fans of porters, but on the lighter side, because even Cafecito, it's a porter, but it's still a bit lighter in body than a regular porter normally is. So we kind of wanted to do something that was kind of like a beer and a cold brew, you know, something easier drinking where you can drink it on its own, or if you'd like, even pour it over ice and it'll still work, you know. So we ended up using this Colombian blend that we really enjoy. And it's actually from a bigger coffee company. We use it from Allegro, and we wanted to use something local, but we just couldn't find something that worked for us with that right balance. So right before we launched, we wanted to use something local, kind of keep everything together, Chicago, but we just decided to go with what we felt was what we enjoyed, you know, and still worked for us. You know, it wasn't a small roaster or anything, which we are still working on doing variants of it with small coffee companies here in Chicago down the road. But for now, it just worked very well when we tried it. So we just decided not to change it. Why mess with it?
In Tempestad, your Imperial Stout, you're using vanilla and cacao. And I thought it was interesting in that one how relatively subtle you kept both of those flavor ingredients. They don't run away with the show. Tell me a little bit about that beer and kind of achieving balance within that.
Yeah, so we're really happy with that one. And it's kind of all across with our beers, especially that one. We, you know, so many stouts are out there that are sometimes just go overboard. Like if they say vanilla that's in there, you really taste the vanilla, like it's present, and sometimes it can be too much, you know. So we wanted a vanilla that we chose one from Veracruz, Mexico. That it's funny because the bean is actually about twice as long as a regular like Madagascar bourbon vanilla bean. But I tell everyone, I describe it as kind of being softer and whiter. So there's a lot more of the little seeds in there, but it's a much mellower flavor. So it's not as sharp as a Madagascar bourbon. So it's like spreads wide a little bit more, which we really enjoy because we want it to be there. We want it to be subtle, but present. And the same thing with the cacao. It's a cacao that I've known for probably, I've worked in the food industry before we actually did full-time brewing. And so I've worked with that bean specifically I've known it for 6-7 years already. And I know it's a great product out of, they bring it out of Ecuador, from Ecuador. So we kind of decided to mix it up a bit with two products we know are very good. And just right after the first attempt, I think we got it just right, where we found the right balance of it, where you still get used to get some chocolate toffee notes from the cacao and the vanilla comes in, but it's still nice and soft and wide.
One last note on the Tempestad. You mentioned you're using Ecuadorian cacao. Who are you sourcing that through? How do you get your cacao?
So that the one we're using, it's from a company called Cho. I think they're based out of San Francisco, TCHO. Like I mentioned, I worked in the food industry for a while, and both companies I was at previously, we distributed their products. So every time something new like that would come across, I would always pick some up to just play around with. And the first time we tried it, we're like, yeah, this is good. Like, yeah. This can work for us. Yeah. So we've always had it in the back of our mind. We've used it in that's what we used in the very first like stout we ever did, probably 3 or 4 months into brewing. And we really enjoyed that beer. So when it was time to do a stout for this, we wanted to just not use any other just the regular vanilla. Because like I said, I think sometimes it can be a little harsh depending on how you dose it. But still, it's a more of a sharp flavor. So in my head, it just seemed like it would work, that cacao with the Veracruz vanilla. And when we came together, it worked out. Because sometimes you can have what you think is a awesome idea or flavor combo or something, and then you try it and you're like, oh man, no, that was off. But yeah, you never know until you try them.
What's next for you in terms of drawing on these familiar flavors? Do you have some beers in the works that you're excited about?
We do. I know Tempestad, we're actually brewing it again very soon. We're working hard to get some tequila barrels, some tequila añejo barrels to throw it in, at least for 6, 7, 8 months. We're excited for that one. And then in September, we also have another one called Media Naranja, which is it's a phrase in Spanish that pretty much means your other half, you know? Like you found your other half in life, you know, your partner, and it kind of just works out perfectly because I'm actually getting married in September, and the beer just happened to be we were able to get everything going, so we're gonna release it the first week of September, so it just adds another level of feeling of you know to that beer, but it's gonna be a nice and more simpler pale ale, citrus forward. We're using Mosaic and Citra, but we're also using orange peel. So yeah, we haven't really done like a pale ale that's like a clear, crystal clear pale ale.
Do those exist anymore?
There's some out here that are delicious, but yeah, we haven't done one. And it's been funny because we've always said like it's a hard beer to do right, like a good pale ale. Like one would think when we started brewing, like you would think this would be an easier beer to do, but no, I mean, you kind of have to get it right, and what we're focusing on is kind of that media naranja, and that's why we're also putting in a little orange peel to kind of just heighten it up a little bit. But we're excited for that one. We need a good pale ale, but we want a good pale ale more importantly.
Looking at the tequila barrel on the Tempestad, that's kind of an unusual flavor combination, tequila with an imperial stout. How do you picture that working together?
So it's been tough because, we don't want to just get any tequila barrel. So we're hoping we can make it happen, but we want a good añejo tequila barrel, like a tequila that we ourselves respect and drink regularly. We don't want to just get a tequila barrel just to say in tequila barrels, you know, we want there to be a story to it, and we want to be happy with the product, you know, and honestly, if we're not able to, we probably won't do it unless we can find something, some kind of a bourbon that we're happy with. But if we don't find a good tequila barrel, or even a more rare is a mezcal añejo barrel. Those are even more rare. And we've made some contacts and are trying to work something out. And hopefully we can make it happen. But I don't think we're going to settle for just like any tequila barrel. It's got to be something that we feel would work well within.
We'll be right back.
Hey, everyone. Final Gravity Issue 4 is now available in the Bean to Barstool shop. This fourth issue of our zine telling intimate, human-centered stories from the world of beer is full of great articles, including Kate Power of Lady Justice Brewing talking about why she might be done with beer festivals, Ukrainian beer writer Lana Svitnikova writing about the Zeugel brewing tradition in Germany, UK writer Matthew Curtis talking about the blend of old and new in the cask ale tradition in Manchester, and many more. We believe passionately in this project, and if you believe the story of beer is ultimately a story about people and relationships, we think you'll love Final Gravity as well. You can order the new issue from our shop on beantobarstool.com, or you can also subscribe, including subscribing for your brewery tap room or break room, or you can subscribe and sign up to support us on Patreon at patreon.com/beantobarstoolzines. Now, back to the episode. If anyone else thinks an imperial stout brewed with cacao and vanilla and aged in añejo tequila or mezcal barrels sounds fascinating, you're not alone. I'll make sure I get my hands on some when it's finally ready. Tempestad is already an indulgent but precise composition, with flavors of chocolate-covered cherry and dark fudgesicle and just the right amount of bitterness. The cacao and vanilla accent the roasted malt of the beer without taking over, allowing the base beer and the flavor ingredients to work together. That same balance is important to Harshith Gupta and his husband Elliot, who run Madhu Chocolate in Austin, Texas. Like the Lopez brothers, Harshith and Elliot got their start making their chocolate at home before launching Madhu, and their chocolate bars are infused with ingredients from Harshith's Indian heritage. Bars like their Saffron Milk 45% bar speak of warm, sunny days. My daughter tasted it for the first time and said it smells like spring, and it really does speak of those first warm days bursting with life. The subtle spice gives a bit of goat milk twang, an earthy, mild green spiciness. It's like something you'd eat when you're sad, my daughter suggested. On the other end of the spectrum, their cardamom dark 60% bar is comforting and seems more suited to the colder turn of the seasons. Cardamom is a spice you feel as much as taste, and here it prickles and shimmers like stars in the night sky or coins in a deep, clear well. Notes of orange, cinnamon, and rose settle into a more earthy warmth. If saffron was spring, this is winter. I spoke with Harshith recently about how he uses Indian spices in his bars. What does it mean to introduce these flavors to the world of chocolate?
So yeah, we have used a lot of like Indian spices, flavors, and nuts. In our chocolates, we have cardamom. Cardamom gets used a lot. We use saffron. Rose water gets used a lot in Indian cooking, but obviously water and chocolate doesn't go well together. Mm-hmm. So instead of rose water, it's rose petals there. And then we have a lot of like flavors, spices like cloves, cardamom, black pepper. These are all like native to India. These are all grows in southern part of India.
When you started making chocolate, was it right away that you wanted to start using these kinds of ingredients? Or was there a moment at which you realized that this was a new way that you could explore and express that?
So yeah, actually what happened was, so we were making chocolate was like as a hobby, it was going on. Now what happened is that we were at a wedding, my cousin's wedding in India, like around several years back. So at the wedding, like the Indian weddings, if you would know, it's like a huge, big extravaganza, like it's a big party, like 2,000, 2,500 people show up.
I've seen movies. I don't know how accurate that is to reality.
They are like really, really lavish. Like it's kind of like you don't even, mostly you don't know. No one knows 2,500 people to know that many people. That's a lot. So it's like you don't know these people, but there's a lot of like food. The thing is, like in the part of the India where my family comes from, we have our cuisine like basically has like it cannot be just like 10 stuff which is in front of you. It has to be at least 60 different savory stuff, and you need to have at least 20-25 of sweets. So it's a little bit of overwhelming experience. Mm-hmm. So at that time when we were there, it was something which kind of like it was more like a aha moment for both of us. It's like, okay, so people know about chicken tikka masala a lot here in US. People know about biryani, naan. This is what like mostly American, they all understand that flavors much more, but they don't know, or they have never been introduced that much to the sweeter part of India. And that is like a huge, like a gamut of sweets by itself. So our entire thing was like, okay, why not we take these flavors and spices which we are actually using in sweets, because sweets, the problem with the Indian sweets are they are all most of the time they are dipped in sugar syrup. So they are very, very sweet. For the Western tooth, I feel like it's much more sweet. Not for me. I love that sweet. But like Elliot, he hates many of those sweets. And not even hate, it's just like it's just too much. Yeah, just like when you squeeze in, it's like all juice of sugar comes in. So our entire thing was like, okay, like why don't we like play around with flavors which we use in the Indian desserts and try to put it in chocolate and see like what happens. Will that be that harmony of these two things will come together properly? It was also that like what would be the right medium for people to understand these flavors, to introduce these flavors. And chocolate is such a beautiful way of people understand it, people know it, people use it every day, and it's not like just one kind of like a section of the society does eats it. It's everyone. It's everywhere. So that gamut is so huge that it was like, it is going to be a good medium for us. So then we started, like when we came back, our entire thing was like, we cannot be doing injustice to chocolate. And also we cannot do an injustice to the spices and the flavors. So they both have to go together. If there are some spices which don't work, they don't work. And you don't like pour something in. Because for us, that is like our biggest kind of like a pet peeve, I would say. Like we will never like pour two things which don't, like a garam masala chocolate. That doesn't, it just doesn't appeal to us because people do it, but it just doesn't appeal because garam masala, when you think in our, my perspective or heritage perspective, it's only in savory food. That's it. I think that is where, like, that was our mostly like our inspiration. That's how the inspiration just came in. It's like, how do we introduce these spices, flavors, nuts into a medium which is something folks will be able to be receptive to?
What part of India were you from?
So my family lives in Mumbai, and I grew up in Mumbai, but my family, like, I think we are from Rajasthan, which is the northern west part of India. It's the it's a part which mostly when you look at India, either shows Taj Mahal or it shows Rajasthan, because it's all these deserts and palaces and kings and all those things come from there. It's Rajasthan actually means the land of the kings. All those like vibrant colors and all, a lot of those come from that part of India.
Oh, that reminds me, what does Madhu mean?
So Madhu is actually my mom's name. And it actually means honey or sweet in Hindi. So it goes well. It's just like, okay, this is all like the entire thing of, Madhu is a very, it's a very sweet thing. it means sweet. And then we have some flavors which are inspired by my mom's cooking, or mom, when mom makes some of the recipes, and then we use it in the chocolate, and it worked out well.
Do you have an example or two of that from your mom's cooking?
So one is our masala chai chocolate, which is actually one of our, like out of all the flavors, that's our top seller. And that masala chai chocolate is exactly, it has five spices, which she puts every morning in her, when she makes chai. And which actually in India, it's like a ritual for every family to drink it three times a day, which is two to three times. For mom, it's three times. So it's like in the morning, then after lunch, then you have it just before evening, like. So she puts a lot of like spices in there, cardamom, cloves, black pepper, ginger, mint, all that stuff which goes in the chocolate. So yeah, so we kind of like got the recipe of like how much she puts exactly. Because the thing is, it's all about those nuances of every spice, how much you want to put in, because every spice has its own notes. And you have to be careful how much you are putting in, because anything will take over the other one. And then that's one part, but then you also don't want to take over the flavor of the chocolate. Have you had a cardamom? Like a pod by itself?
Tried? I don't know that I've actually bitten into a pod.
So yeah, there is a two different kind of cardamom. One is a green cardamom and there is a black cardamom. Those are bigger pods. So that gets used a lot in like biryani and like in like a lot of like savory food we put in. By any chance, when you're eating your curry and you bite on one of those, then you're done. Like you're like the meal is done, because it lingers around there in your mouth, and then your entire flavor profile has changed. So for us, it was very important that the cardamom is such a like a such a beautiful spice. It's one of the most expensive spices you can buy as well. But like, how do you use it in a way which actually it still you get the flavor, but it doesn't like make you feel like, once I'm done with the chocolate, after 5 or 10 minutes of eating it, I should not have like, I should have chocolate in my mouth, not cardamom lingering around. So that's one of those. Then we also had another one, which we actually, right now, it was our Christmas special, which was it's not Christmas, holiday special. And that was our take on peanuts, peanut chocolate, because peanuts and chocolate go really well together, as we all, it's like a very classic combination of chocolate. So there we had a spicy peanut chocolate, which is actually, the spicy peanuts are basically something in Diwali, which is our, for Hindus, that's our Christmas. Diwali, which happens in November, October time frame. It's a festival of lights. So every family will make their snacks for anyone else who will come to their home. And one of the snacks is spicy peanuts. It's a very common thing which you'll see around. Like people use it when they are having drinks as well, as a part of like to take, get the acidity and like to cut out some of the bitterness from the drink itself. Sure. So it's a very classic thing which we have there, and we try to use that in our chocolate. And it actually, like, yeah, it was, like, when we had that, we wanted to keep it some things for occasion and not have it all around. So that was one of those. So, yeah, those are two flavors which were, like, totally, like, according to how she makes it. And it's kind of like when we did the first few times, it was her who was doing that first part for us. Because I'm like, I don't know, you have to do it. Because the problem with the Indian moms is that when we talk about, like, oh, a mom, I want to make XYZ today, she will just say like, oh yeah, so you just put some cumin powder in there. They will never tell you how much, because no one knows exactly. They all do it by eye. Like, it's mostly like, yeah, you just look at the pot and you just look at the color and you see like the, oh yeah, this looks right. So yeah. And it happens a lot with me and Elliot, because I'm also kind of, I've become used to, I will, like, I'm a good cook, and I know, like, from my mom, I've learned a lot of cooking, and I am, like, really good at my cooking skills and all. But now when I'm like, Elliot wants to impress me and he wants to make the same thing, I'm like, yeah, I don't know. I'm, this is what I do. You just have to follow it. You have to look at it yourself. And then, it's just flavors. You have to, like, it's difficult for me myself to explain it to another person. So I kind of, like, I should not even say Indian moms. It's mostly, like, Indian cooking itself.
You mentioned cardamom being this way, but a lot of the ingredients you're using are potentially quite bold flavors. You know, the cardamom, coriander, the citrus fruits, rose, all of those could get overpowering pretty quickly. How do you go about balancing those within the context of a bar?
Before we started our own business, what we realized is, like, whenever I would buy a lot of these craft chocolates, what I saw is the chocolate packaging will say some flavor chocolate. Mm-hmm. You open it, you're all excited to eat this thing. When you look at the back of the bar, they have like few sprinkles of something that flavor is. And then when you bite on it, it's like, okay, I get the chocolate and then I get the raw of whatever was that flavor. And then if I miss some part, you're not putting it like totally, like what I would say, very uniformly over the entire bar. So you will get some part which doesn't have any of that. So then it's like, all right, I'm just eating a chocolate. Then I'm not eating, because if I'm getting a chocolate which is some flavor, then I want that flavor. That's it's kind of like our thing there, I would say. So what we saw is that if I'm putting anything just at the back of the bar, like if I take a cardamom and if I take a cardamom powder, I just pour it at the back of the bar, which I think will taste disgusting because cardamom powder is so like strong. But any other thing, like if I'm doing a much more uniform thing on that, like we had recently Askinosi had this like a toasted coconut chocolate, and that toasted coconut was like, as soon as I went to the back, every square inch of the chocolate is filled with toasted coconut. So you have to get toasted coconut in there. But it's not like, oh, you will not get it. So there it's okay. Like, yeah, maybe you can have a balance that way. But our thing was like, when we talk about a chocolate has a flavor, when I say saffron milk, saffron should be in the chocolate so that whenever I'm eating a part of, whichever part of the chocolate I'm eating, you are getting that flavor. Now, one thing which happens is like with when we started doing rose pistachio, that was one of our classic one. So when people think about rose pistachio, first of all, first thing which comes to mind is, will it taste like purpurry or something like that? Because because it's rose, and it can go overwhelming. It can also taste like very perfumey for many people. Mm-hmm. So it can be very much like, it can become like in a way of like many people will just not like it. So when we were playing around with this thing, we had batches of this chocolate, which were made at like different percentage of how much ingredients are going in. And there were some percentages wherein it was like, yeah, I will not even, we ourselves cannot even eat that. And then it was more like a making the same type of chocolate with the same percentage, but playing around with this with our percentage of how much of like rose petals and pistachio needs to go in, so that you can see like exactly what is that point wherein it's not perfumey, it's not something which will taste like I'm eating a, like rose by itself, but I'm also getting like I'm getting a nice beautiful rose flavor to it. But then it is also giving me the chocolate flavor. So the first thing was that like, oh, it cannot be just at the back of the bar. Any part which has rose petals in it, if I eat it, I will only taste rose petals. And because the thing is, what happens is, because the human eye, when you eat anything, we smell. then we look, and then we eat. So I've already made my perception at that point that this will taste like rose. All of ours, most of these ingredients goes into the melanger. They run for days and days. So what happens with doing that is, first of all, you are making uniformity with the that spices or that flavor is going throughout the chocolate, but it also doing that, it mellows down the flavor a little. So this is exactly what happens in Indian cooking. Indian cooking, when most of the curries, the day you make it, it doesn't taste good. It tastes really good the next day, and the next day it tastes even better. It's because what happens is the flavors, they basically bind together with the whatever is the base you're using. It's like that principle of the cooking is what we are applying in the chocolate. First of all, you have to use the spice in such a way that you are releasing some of the oil. So like with when we talk about like a coriander or like when we talk about cardamom, what happens is when you're running this for 72 hours or something like that, what happens is that the cardamom starts releasing its oils and all. The flavor profile starts like decimating into the entire part of the chocolate. And also it also lowers a little bit of the intensity of the cardamom as well. Like now for that one, it was like, oh, first of all, for any flavor, it is basically, oh, how long we have to run the machine for. It's like how long the entire process has to run. For some, we are making the same 60% dark chocolate, but how much cardamom is going in and how much of time you're running it, what is the, because roast profile at that point remains the same. So now like when you are doing this, so we make like, at least we have to make like 5 to 6 different kind of like variations to see where it will be like a good point for people to be able to enjoy it. But it should also not be that way that I'm putting so less of something that I'm like, yeah, I ate the chocolate, but I didn't taste it at all. Yeah. Sometime it happened. And for us, that was one of the problems we had with saffron milk. What we saw is that when we were making saffron milk, saffron, as you know, is the most expensive spice.
Right.
That's like the most expensive thing, more than gold can be. So it's already, you are taking this really beautiful, delicate, very precious spice. And what we were doing is like, we were just butchering it. We were like, as in all the chocolates we were putting, saffron was going at the time when the sugar and everything was already like kind of like has like worked in for like at least 10 hours or something. And we were putting saffron in there, saffron powder will go. And then we will run it for another, whatever, 2 days or something. Now what happened with saffron is that saffron is a very, very delicate flavor. So with us running it for that long, the saffron actually kind of like started evaporating. The flavor started evaporating out of it. So sure. That was one thing. So what would happen is when we would do like at farmer's market, that was our first place where we started selling. Farmer's market, where you get a very direct feedback because it's a place where people will just tell you there itself because you're handing over them samples. And many times it would happen when you were giving saffron sample, it is like, yeah, you should taste it at your back of your throat. We know that there is saffron in there, but it will like sometimes saffron will come a little later. Sometimes people will not have patience to wait for that. They will leave, and then from somewhere further out, they will just yell and say, "Oh, now it tastes saffron." And like so, it will happen a lot like that for them. So it is kind of like, okay, there is something when we have to explain people that, oh, you should taste this saffron. Then the problem was like when you are selling it at a retail store, there's no sampling, people are just buying it, they don't taste it by some reason, then what do you, like, they are not going to buy that back, and you want a regular customer. So what we started doing is for like very particularly for saffron, I think it's the only one right now wherein saffron actually goes during tempering process. So the saffron goes at that time.
Okay.
The saffron is so delicate. So it just like, because it's tempering. So it's basically, it's mixing up. So over time, it's mixing up. The entire bowl is getting all saffron, but the saffron still remains because this is like a very pure, like Persian saffron, which you're using. And we were just like, basically, we were disobeying that spice, like such a beautiful spice. So it's kind of like those nuances is something which I understand because when I'm looking at like how my mom is making some sweets, where she is putting these things, which stage these things needs to go. I would say like for us, that is where my part of like work became important in the entire role of this chocolate and making the flavors is that understanding like when and how you put these flavors in so that we are not disobeying those flavors. We are also not taking away the experience of chocolate.
I found it interesting that Madhu's chocolates inspired by Indian desserts and Casa Humilde's beers inspired by Mexican culinary flavors share many ingredients in common, like coriander, citrus, and vanilla. Madhu's Lemon Coriander 78% bar shows a fascinating interplay between the bright flavor ingredients and the deeper, richer character of the Tumaco Colombian beans from Uncommon Cacao, which they use for all of their bars. Jose and Javier pair coriander with another citrus fruit, orange peel, in Pilan, a Belgian ale also brewed with Piloncillo sugar. Orange peel and coriander are a relatively common combination in Belgian brewing, most commonly found together in the wheat-based wit beer style. The Piloncillo ferments out entirely, leaving behind an impression of dark fruit with wildflower honey, but without the associated sweetness that plays with the earthy spice of the Belgian yeast. And the sunny flavors of gentle pear, subtle lime zest, and sweet orange layer over top like birds in the branches. While the flavors Harshit and Jose are working with are familiar and deeply resonant for them and their families and cultures, many of the consumers with whom they're sharing their products are new to some of these ingredients. I asked Jose about his own connection to these flavors and the importance of education in bridging the gap for newcomers.
So at the brewery, we do have, on our busier days, not every day, but for the weekends, we do have what we call beer guides. And they're trained to our beers. They know our beers. So a lot of people aren't familiar with what a prickly pear is. And sometimes they see the color of the label and they see red, a deep red, and they think it's going to be like a sweet beer. Or sometimes the color on the beer can be a little brighter than the previous batch, depending on the fruit. When they see that, they kind of expect to have a sweet flavor from that beer. But our guides and ourselves, when we're there as well, we kind of explain what it is, where it grows from, you know, because sometimes we'll see a review where it says, yeah, it tastes nothing like pear. You know, we're like, yeah, no, it doesn't taste like a pear. That's for sure, you know.
Yeah.
So we definitely like to do that. We'll highlight on our social media posts as well, kind of explaining what the fruit is, the story behind the beer, where it comes from, and kind of what the fruit itself, the flavor is, just to kind of help people kind of know where they're heading if they're going to try that beer.
What do these flavors mean to you now when you taste one of your beers that has, you know, something like prickly pear in it that has that childhood memory attached to it? Does that still mean something new to you and give you a new experience?
Honestly, it does bring a new experience just because we were able to kind of capture that and bring it out to people. And now it's like more people are connecting with it. You know, like we'll get some people that like, hey, that's, you know, my family's from Zacatecas, you know, that's, I'm very familiar with that flavor. So a lot of people, other people making that connection, like just heightens it up for us, you know, like it's a great feeling. Like we still enjoy it. It still always brings back those memories, which we're grateful and happy for. It still does that for us. And I think it always will, to be quite honest. But when we get to see other people kind of make that connection as well, it's an awesome feeling.
What's the last beer you had from another brewery that gave you some kind of new experience? You know, whether it's a flavor you weren't familiar with or a flavor that you were familiar with that, you know, took you back in memory or something like that. What's another beer that you've had that's done that recently?
That's a good question. Actually, the last one I enjoyed was from Pipeworks here in Chicago, maybe about a month or two ago. They came out with an horchata ale, and they did a very great job at it. Like, I wasn't sure what to expect. I know what horchata is, so when someone else is using it, I kind of feel like, all right, let's see what this is all about. Mm-hmm. You know, and I tried it and I enjoyed it very much. And it's kind of that same feeling, you know, it connects you to home, to your culture, to who you are. And it's funny because I had one as well. This is kind of taking it back, but from the brewery in California, where they did an horchata ale, and this was maybe 6-7 years ago, I think. And I tried it, and I'm like, oh, they did a great freaking job with this beer. So when I tried this Pipeworks one, I'm like, all right, I'm young. So I found two horchata beers that I've tried and I really enjoyed. Because I tried others, and some of them are just like they missed the mark, yeah. You know. And sometimes I think it's hard to work with something if you're not that familiar with that flavor. Mm-hmm. You know, and we all work with ingredients and experiment and play around, but I think we'll all have a different reaction to the flavor. But yeah, I think that one would be the last one, the Pipeworks looked at that one.
Hersheath echoed this dichotomy between customers who feel the excitement of recognition when they taste a familiar flavor and those who are approaching these for the very first time. He shared an interesting educational tool he uses when opening this world of flavor to first-timers at the farmer's market where he and Elliot sell some of their bars. What has your experience been with these chocolates that have flavors that are pretty specific to the culture that you come from, with whether people are encountering those for the very first time or people are very familiar with those flavors and are having like a moment of recognition? How have you seen that play out?
So it's both sides, which we have seen, both sides of it, wherein there are people, like when we talk about like saffron milk, many people have been like, when they see the saffron milk, they're like, okay, what is saffron? It all comes down to the first question. Then the first thing before us to explain to them, okay, so you have seen, have you had paella before? In paella, the thing which is yellow is what is saffron. But then now the problem is with paella, and the thing which is mostly many people are familiar with, it doesn't have any, like saffron doesn't do any like flavoring to it. You just see the color of it. So now what happens is for saffron, what we have done, like Elliot made me this spice box for one of the Christmas as a gift. Mm-hmm. So that spice box is filled with all the spices which we use, and we will take that to the farmer's market with us. And that was one of our thing to show people, like when someone talks about, hey, what's saffron?
That's great.
Here is the saffron. Smell it. I not taste it most of the time, but right. Smell it. Because that's like, yeah, it's too expensive for me to just give it to for sampling, but smell it. When they smell that thing, they understood what it is. Many people were able to either familiarize themselves. They understood like, oh, I had something like similar sometimes in mango lassi, in a nicer, fancier place, they will put like a little bit saffron in it. So you will get that taste in there. Some people didn't have any idea, but when they tried it, then like, oh, this is such a delicate and beautiful flavor. For some people, it was they started appreciating it as soon as we say that how expensive saffron is. Because many people have a different point of view. Some people are like, oh, as soon as they hear that something is Louis Vuitton, then they start liking it because of just being that, right? It's kind of like that. So we had like a lot of people with like that one, I know very clearly like saffron was like. Now with cardamom was a very interesting one. So cardamom is where like when many people call it cinnamon, first of all. So as soon as they read cardamom, but they don't understand cardamom. So they say, that's a cinnamon chocolate. Then we have to tell them that it's a cardamom. So with cardamom, it's the same thing. We have a pods. It's not that expensive. We'll just, hey, take one cardamom, open it up, just like smell it. If you really are adventurous, eat a little bit of it. Just a very little, just open the pod, take one of the seed and just like bite on it. Because it's a very common thing in India. People do it as a mouth freshener because it has that aroma and stuff.
Sure.
So it's like, okay, you can try that way. When people like ate the cardamom, the first thing they're like, oh my God, I had this thing in, the last time I had a biryani, I tasted the same flavor there because it's used so much in that. Like cardamom goes so much in that. I had a paneer tikka masala or something like that. They put in sometimes. In some places, they will do that. So some people were like, we were able to associate it with that. That was one part of it, like who had an experience to it. Or some people have worked with it. Many people, like I've seen this with the vegan community a lot. Like because the vegan community, like when you go into veganism, a lot of your food habits kind of like tend towards more like Indian cooking a lot because it's a very vegetarian and a very vegetable focused. If you have those books at home, you tend to start using cardamom a lot in your food because that is gets used there. So that's one population where we saw like people were like already like they knew it. Like it's like, okay, whenever we go to any vegan pop-up markets and all, people are like, yeah, cardamom is like, they all know it. Then we saw another population we saw is very interesting was like the people who are from Scandinavian countries. That was a very interesting thing. In Scandinavia, somehow the Southeast Asian spice went all the way to Scandinavia somehow. And so now cardamom gets used a lot in their cooking. Wow. So like all these Scandinavian, like Finnish and all, any like background people will come to us are like, oh yeah, for them, it's like, this is our flavor. This is like Swedish and all, they know that flavor because it gets used so much. And then there are some people who are actually, oh, this is too adventurous, too much of a flavor in there. And that is totally fine as well. Like, and then like when it comes to like, if there is anyone comes from a South Asian background who comes as a customer or a Middle Eastern who comes as a customer, they all understand it. Like they see saffron, they are all like, oh yeah, that's like a no-brainer for us.
What is their reaction to it? Do they have any kind of like emotional reaction to that?
Yeah, for like saffron and for cardamom masala chai, they get like excited. And then when they see saffron milk, it's like, oh, for them, it's like excitement. It's just like for people, it just reminds of their childhood so much. Or like also in India, still like, obviously I have like not lived in India for like the past 11 years now or something. But like what I know is like the people have much more sweeter tooth there. So we have a lot of sweets. It's like a wealth thing there. So, and what we have seen is like people are much more into sweeter chocolates. I tend to put darker chocolate, but those, that milk chocolate, as soon as they see something like a saffron or like, I think masala chai is another one. Masala chai gets a lot of like, as soon as people eat it, the first thing is, oh my God, it just feels like my mom is hugging me right now. It's like that kind of feeling. And that is like what we see, like, oh, this is how my mom will make it. Or people will be like, oh my God, that just reminds me, my last trip, I did it to India when I was in here. And I had this, I would drink this chai every like 3 or 4 times a day. So it brings a lot of nostalgia to people. And obviously that is what is rewarding. And it also like kind of validates the entire thing of like what we are doing as well. It validates that like our flavors are not just like both of us saying that this is how it should be, but people also are giving a feedback on that. So
yeah, you're working with these every day. So you're involved in the process of creating these flavors and you don't get to have that first time experience that your customer does of tasting these bars. But do you still have any kind of emotional reaction to those flavors when you taste one of your own chocolates?
Yeah. So for me, like when I'm doing like a cardamom, for me, cardamom is such a, like, it just reminds me of all the different sweets which my mom made. It just reminds of that. Like, it's a very much like, it's just like that, like memory of like, oh yeah, like this is like, reminds me exactly how she used to make the, when she's not here, when she's here, she will make the same kind of stuff. And then, yeah. And there is another one which we have is, it's our coconut milk cashew, which actually is the most like common dessert, I would say, which you will see throughout India. It will be a different takes to it, but it's kheer. Kheer is basically a rice pudding, and it has like a lot of nuts. It has like it has cashews, it has saffron, and it has like cardamom in it. It's basically, you're taking milk and rice and you're cooking it for hours and hours. Mm-hmm. So you get like a nice pudding. And that is what, like, when I eat that, it's just like, it's like, oh yeah, I just had kheer right now. For me, it's like, that is my kheer of it, because I don't want to make it myself. So for Elliot, we have orange clove chocolate. So orange clove is like, we use orange clove, like oranges and cloves by itself in like in desserts as well. But orange clove by both of them were more like Elliot's take on, his family used to do those oranges with like during Christmas time, and they would start cloves and stuff. So it just reminds him, like, it's exactly like, he's like in a nicer version of that. It just reminds him the citrusy and the clovey notes to it. So it's kind of like, for us, it's like those flavors just like, yeah, they it's just like there's a lot of reminiscence to something. It's like, it just feels like Christmas to me when I'm eating it.
Yeah. What does your mom think of those chocolates?
So mom, like, for her, she has a sweet tooth. She doesn't understand the dark chocolate that much. So she doesn't go for like 70. Those are like, oh yeah, that's like not even a chocolate for her. It's like, so for her, it's like the saffron milk and masala chai, and orange clove as well. Because orange clove has such a, because there's oranges at the studded at the back of the bar. So that kind of makes it like much more like you get to eat the orange as well. Sure. So it's it gives her that like a nice flavor to it. And obviously like she also loves citrusy fruits a lot. But like saffron and masala chai for her also is like her to go kind of like, yeah, chocolate. They are sweeter because like saffron milk is something which like back in India, whenever she has taken the bars, they are the most hit ones because because people understand that, people appreciate it more because of that reason. So it's just that, like, entire, and it's also sweeter. It's only like 45% cacao, so much more on the sweeter side, chocolate. Yeah.
While I don't, of course, have those same intimate memories and reassuring connotations around masala chai that Harshith mentioned, it's not hard to imagine feeling those when tasting this bar. This bar is an autumn sunrise with a complex but interlaced spice profile with vanilla, cardamom, and clove, and underlying notes of black tea and orange peel, and some subtler plum-like notes peeking through, possibly from the cacao itself. It's comforting but energetic, like a bright October morning. And the packaging for Madhu's bars is equally bright, with intricate, colorful patterns. I keep my favorite chocolate packaging to use as stationery for writing letters or to use in collage work, and these will definitely get used when I finish the chocolate itself. You can check the Bean to Barstool Instagram page for examples of Madhu's packaging in the coming days. Harshith explains the importance of this packaging and what it conveys about the spirit and culture behind the company.
Sure. So so we are, I don't know if I said, but yeah, we are an Indian-inspired chocolate. So it's all, we want to keep it true, as much true as we can, with the Indian spices, to the culture, to how, like, when people think about India, there are two parts people think. One is about the opulence, the brightness, the colorfulness, mm-hmm. everything being much more louder, because that's how things are when it comes to colors with the food and all. And the mm-hmm. other part is things are also poor there, and things are the a slumdog millionaire kind of
sure.
That also is it's two parts. So that the part which is about our pride and the heritage which we have, I wanted to make sure that heritage also comes out in our packaging. And what we see is in saris, which is the Indian, most of the Indian women wear saris. Mm-hmm. Saris is a 9 feet long drape, which women will wear every day kind of thing. So so they have these hand block prints on them. And these are hand block prints. They're stitched prints and all. And these are very, very articulate, very colorful, very, very detailed work which gets done on each sari. So we actually took, that was our inspiration on all of our packaging. It was basically, we wanted to make sure that when we introduce these flavors, it's about the chocolate. It's the experience of the chocolate. And also it makes you, when you look at something which is pretty, something which you feel like you are taking a piece of some heritage with you. So that's what our entire thing was. When you look at any of the bars, they have that feel that, oh, many of our customers have actually showed us pictures that they never throw any of our packaging, because those packaging are beautiful. And they have shown us so many pictures. We have seen that. Some people have made the case for their phone by cutting our logo and then just putting it at the back so that they can see their camera. It's kind of it goes in a way wherein people are many people have asked, oh, can you make something else with it? Can you use these prints and make something with a scarf out of it so that we can wear it? Because people want that. It's that kind of So when you look at all these, you go to Central Market or Whole Foods and you see a wall of chocolate. Just like you see, you go to Total Wine and More and you see a wall of wine. What would be the reaction of a person to buy, why they will buy this and why they will not buy this? Or what is that reaction? What is that kind of thing? So we kind of did a little bit of that research on ourselves of going literally to these stores and just standing there and analyzing people. And it was kind of weird to do that, but we had to do it because that's how we understand what is the reaction. So what we see is that people do people have when there are I'm unfamiliar with these three things and they're all of my same price range and the same kind of thing, it's more eeny miny mo kind of thing at that point. So that was another thing which was important to us. It was it has to be how we will make sure, how we will work so that when we are not there to represent our brand, the brand is representing itself and it's also standing out from the crowd. Obviously, definitely there is work, there's always in progress work we are never satisfied with our own packaging. We are always looking for like, how should we make it better? And that's like, you always want to do things like that. Yeah. But that was like, the inspiration came there. It was also like, on the business side, it was also like, okay, how do we make sure that people will be more, people will be more enticed towards buying this over something else? But then it was also like, okay, they buy it because that's a one-time buy someone did. How do you make them, you make them a regular customer? That is when they open it and then they eat it.
Well, and I think when they, especially with your packaging, because you're using so much imagery that people recognize as coming from Indian culture, mm-hmm. it kind of puts them in the mindset of understanding that these are going to be a certain type of flavor. I mean, if they're from here in the United States and they're not as familiar with some of those flavors, it kind of puts them in the mindset of having a new experience.
So it's kind of like, it's also like, it just makes them like, so we had like these customers. So we had like a rose pistachio. When you open the rose pistachio, it has like at the back of the bar, there's rose petals and pistachio. So the reaction which people have like seen at the farmers market is like, oh, so when I get this bar, it is not even pretty from outside. When I open it, I see all these pretty things, which makes me feel more prettier. When I eat it, it makes me feel more happier and prettier.
After explaining how quality ingredients help connect people to the flavors in his beers, Jose explained that same desire for connection goes into Casa Humilde's merchandise, packaging, and taproom experience.
And that kind of goes with some of our merchandise that we're working on as well. Like we're getting some Mexican shirts made in Guerrero, Mexico, you know, and when we get them here and we're able to sell them, we're able to put up the story, put up pictures of the people who actually created these and kind of have people make a connection to it, you know? Yeah, we're big on that, on having people connect with the product, with the story. It just adds another level of, excitement. It connects people. And because that's how we see product, you know? When I find out about a company or a product, I kind of like to dig deeper and see like who's behind it, where they're sourcing stuff. And, you know, it connects me a lot more to it. So that's kind of what we like to do as well.
What are some other ways that that storytelling element fits in with what you're doing there?
Well, like on our packaging, on the cans, depending on what type of beer, but the majority of them will have kind of like our motto, you know, it'll say Hermanos, Orgullo, Cultura. We want our brand to represent who we are, you know. First of all, we're brothers, you know, with the ingredients we use, we represent our culture, and you know, we're proud of it. You know, we're proud of who we are, and we want to showcase our ingredients in our beers. But another thing is, like at the tap room, so where we're at is District Brew Yard. So it's four breweries in one building. Each brewery has their wall with 10 different beers, and we each have our own decor. We brought in tile from Mexico. It's part of the top. It's stucco. The logo's hand painted, and then every month we rotate in a new local artist. So we bring in local artists from Chicago, and they get to display as many. It could be any, depending on the size of the pieces, as anywhere from 5 to 10 to 12 different pieces on our wall, and on one of our side walls. And we also allow them to sell their artwork there. We take no commission, Brew Yard takes no commission. We just want to expose more people and connect them more to what we're trying to do with our brand. And that has been pretty awesome, you know, because once a month we kind of get a new wall, you know, kind of a new decor, and it works great. Some of the artists sometimes like work on pieces specifically for our branding, just for that wall, which a lot of times is pretty awesome. And sometimes they bring in like sets that they have already, but everyone enjoys it, and they sell a good amount of pieces, which is good for the artists as well.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah.
What's behind your name, Casa Humilde?
Casa Humilde means humble home. It's pretty much just based off of our upbringing, how we were raised by our parents, our grandparents, and how they brought us up, how they always taught us to be, and pretty much to help anyone wherever we can, and always be inviting and welcoming. So that's kind of what we like to do with the brand. You know, like we kind of make beers for everyone. You know, we don't want to go heavy into one style or one trend. You know, we want there to be something, a little bit of something for everyone, you know.
As I tasted Casa Humilde beers like Nopale, made with prickly pear cactus, an ingredient I was unfamiliar with beforehand, I was struck by how approachable and relatable they are, even as they offer flavors that are new to many people. I scribbled down a list of refreshing flavors Nopale brought to mind. Pale stone fruit, pepper, lime zest, underripe tart honeydew, melon, sage, mint, that don't quite capture the flavor of prickly pear cactus, but do speak to the excitement and complexity of this beer on a fresh palate, even while it stays bright and easy to drink. When we taste chocolate and beer, or another food or drink, with someone from a different background as ourselves, we open empathic doors that allow us to see flavor through the eyes of someone with a different set of memories. We are better able to hear and feel each other's stories, and we fill in the gaps in each other's sensory catalogs. When that chocolate or beer is made by someone from a different background as ourselves, we are being offered an invitation to connect, and we should approach that experience with humility and curiosity. If you've had the chance to try Casa Humilde's beers or Madhu's chocolates, I'd love to hear from you, whether you found flavors that are familiar and evocative for you, or new sensory discoveries that challenged or excited you. Jose mentioned Cafecito, his coffee porter, and we'll be discussing the use of coffee in chocolate and beer in another episode soon. In the next episode of Bean to Barstool, we'll take beers and chocolates from the last two episodes and find compelling pairings for them, building on the pairing ideals we introduced in episode 4. Be sure to join me for that. You can learn more about my guests and their businesses, Harshith Gupta of Madhu Chocolate and Jose Lopez of Casa Humilde Cerveceria, in the show notes. The music for this episode was performed by my friend Anna P.S. You can find out more about her in the show notes or at her website, annapsmusic.com. I hope you enjoyed this episode of Bean to Barstool.